The dream of the internet was that it would connect the globe and lead to an age of information.
But with the rise of social media, disinformation has been reigning tyrant.
This has caused many nations to begin adopting digital sovereignty measures.
But what is digital sovereignty?
And are we witnessing the death of the World Wide Web? I'm Jason Acuna.
And I'm Regan McCarthy. And seriously, what is digital sovereignty?
Well, I spoke with a content creator that's been following the topic, so we'll find out next on Unbothered by WFSU.
Hi, I'm Drew Lyon, and I am Drew for now. I'm a content creator, and I started calling myself the premier opinion writer on TikTok and other social channels, like wherever you get your video social media hits, I'm probably there.
Absolutely, Drew. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate you being here, and I'm really excited for this conversation we're going to have on digital sovereignty. So I'll just jump right into my first question. Can you give us a definition of digital sovereignty and maybe describe a little bit about its origins for us?
Digital sovereignty has a lot of definitions, actually, depending on who you talk to. The way that I think about it in my series, Actually What's Happening, where we talk about like 20 different big global news topics every month, is that digital sovereignty is the idea that a country should have the right to control what happens in its digital space, the same way that it controls what happens in its like physical borders. Which sounds very reasonable, but the problem is that the internet and like our digital lives weren't really built with borders in mind. They were really built in this idea like to democratize information for everybody. So because it was specifically designed to sort of route around borders, when governments try to assert sovereignty over digital space, they're kind of drawing lines on water. And so lots of different leaders in government and tech are trying to find ways to protect private citizen data and government borders and like company sovereignty as well, and do all of that while making sure that everybody can still access like a free and accessible internet. So it's a really interesting topic to like think about.
And so can you give us a few examples of what digital sovereignty is looking like right now across the globe?
Yeah, because it isn't a single thing and it's kind of a spectrum, different countries and different areas are sort of handling digital sovereignty in different ways. So one approach is like what the European Union is doing, and they're really prioritizing individual citizens' rights as a way to safeguard their democracy. So they're writing regulations to protect citizen data and privacy in ways that I think are actually really cool and probably will work pretty well. The second approach to digital sovereignty would be something like China, which has a really famous, like what's called the Great Firewall, and Russia more recently, and they're prioritizing protecting government interests first by doing things like censoring data, like China did back in the 90s when they started censoring the internet, and they basically made it so that like if you Google something and you're in China, you can't really like learn much about like the Tiananmen Square massacre, for example, that happened in 1989, because China sort of wanted to protect government interests, and so they started like sort of splitting off parts of the internet and kind of protecting their government interests as a way to implement digital sovereignty. And Russia's doing that more recently by banning YouTube and kind of prosecuting Telegram. And third, I think the US has a different model where the US is sort of prioritizing business and private sector rights through massive deregulation of the tech sector. And so each of those, like, sort of, I think, give the world a different internet and also different rights for different areas of our lives. And so, I don't know, I'm happy to like dig into more of those if one of those is like interesting to you. The EU, I think, is particularly making a lot of moves right now in different countries. But also, it's not just those three like major powers. Like every country has different ways they're thinking about digital sovereignty. Like Canada has different laws around like how news sites can appear on social media. Brazil and India have both banned different social media sites. African countries, like there are 44 different countries in Africa that have different data protection laws to protect any side of that sort of. So it's like every place is sort of being touched by this concept right now.
Absolutely. So every country's going about it kind of their own individual way, but it does seem like there's kind of three main paths, which is governmental focus, a personal focus on the citizens, and then a corporate focus on the companies in a country.
Yeah, right. And I think like one way you could think about it is like, I don't know, what do you do? When I go to a new website and it asks me to like accept or reject cookies, do you accept them or do you reject? Do you manage cookies?
Personally, I think I reject them usually.
You do? For me, it's like a every hour. I don't know which one I'll choose. It's like I don't know, a lottery for the cookie people. I sometimes accept them and sometimes I reject them. But the reason that you have to do that is because Europe, several years ago, put a law in place called GDPR, which has forced anybody that's like running a website in Europe to have that pop-up come up because they wanted to protect citizen data from being used by other countries and other companies outside of Europe. And so they like kind of forced everybody in Europe to say, you have to have this pop-up so the individuals can reject the cookies and reject being tracked by your site. And most companies around the world just decided, well, if we have to do it for Europe, we'll just do it for everyone. And so, like, you can see where, like, this actually impacts all of our lives in different ways. And so Europe often is the leader in that sort of like personal data privacy part. And that's actually, there's a thing called it. It's called, there's a thing, there's actually a concept called the Brussels effect, which is that idea that Europe is the leading force in private data policy and that the rest of the world sort of follows Europe.
Absolutely, yeah. In my research for this, I did see that there were at least, looks like, five major acts passed in the European Union to kind of combat this: the EU Data Act, the Data Governance Act, the Digital Services Act, Digital Markets Act, and the AI Act. So they're definitely, pumping out this legislation, trying to bolster their digital sovereignty for their citizens.
Yeah, and it's kind of crazy because like those acts are like they'll pass that and then it takes a few years for those to like be implemented, which makes sense because like lots of technology companies have to then find ways to build their infrastructure to actually like make it actually work. But like the AI Act is really interesting because some of it has been implemented, but not all of it yet. And like probably by the end of 2026 and the beginning of 2027, we'll start to see how that all comes together. And that too, I think will really impact like what happens. Like if you ever travel to Europe, you may see starting like next year that when you are like Googling and you get like the little AI summary at the top of Google, or if you ask ChatGPT or Claude or LeMistral is like sort of the Le Chat is the French version of ChatGPT, sort of. If you ask any of those the same question in Europe versus the US in 2027, I bet you'll start to get different answers because there's different AI infrastructure and different like limits placed on what AI companies can use from a like data and privacy perspective and sort of like a danger and hate speech perspective in Europe. That will be different than what you would get in the US because it's less regulated here in the US. And so, like, we're going to start to see, I think, in different countries, particularly, and also possibly in different states, like a different internet and a different AI experience, particularly because of all those like laws that are being passed. And I don't know, like, maybe the AI law that you just referenced will also be sort of implemented globally, like GDPR with all the cookies, and maybe not. We're just not sure how it's all going to pan out yet. But it's really interesting to watch.
So pivoting to the United States for a moment, I know that with the kind of forced sale of the US side of TikTok, that can kind of be one example of the United States exerting some digital sovereignty. What are some other examples of what the United States is doing currently to kind of put this concept into effect?
Yeah. The TikTok ban, I think, is a particularly wild one because the US in mid-February, Secretary of State Marco Rubio put out an internal cable to US diplomats worldwide, actively opposing foreign data sovereignty and data localization laws. And Reuters reported that just a couple weeks ago. And that sort of is saying that, like, the federal government in the US is telling other countries, you should not pass digital sovereignty legislation because it's bad for free speech. And I think there's like maybe a case to be made there where as more regulations go into place to protect private citizen data, there is potentially a trade-off between like that data collection and the like sort of incognito privacy that you could access on the internet. And so like he's telling diplomats to tell foreign like nations not to implement these laws. But at the same time, the US is implementing essentially laws like that by saying, you know, we think that TikTok is really dangerous to US citizens. It's a growing platform. Like hundreds of millions of Americans use TikTok, and it's owned and operated by China, which is a danger to US citizens. And so we can't allow that. And legally, Congress passed this law a couple years ago, and then the Supreme Court upheld it to say, like, TikTok either needs to be banned from the US or TikTok needs to come under US majority ownership. And President Trump took a bunch of actions for that. And ultimately, just like a few months ago, like TikTok did come under U.S. ownership. And so the U.S. is both saying to other countries, don't implement digital sovereignty laws while also implementing our own digital sovereignty laws, which I think is like a really fascinating piece. But it's not just like in that international space. Like actually, last year, Congress also had a bill that was on the floor saying they wanted to put like a moratorium on all AI legislation from individual states, and that Congress was trying to say that the only legislation that could be put into practice around AI had to come from the federal government, that states couldn't have their individual laws enacted. And that actually, that law failed on the floor. But because it failed on the floor, a bunch of states have their own like digital sovereignty laws that have gone into action. So like California is often similar to the EU in that it tries to protect private citizen data. So there are like training data disclosure mandates for AI. There are AI transparency requirements in California. One law that I thought was really interesting in the US is the Elvis Act in Tennessee, which is really based around like the music industry that's based in Nashville, which bans AI voice clones. So like Reba McEntire could sue a tech company if they like had a voice clone of her distinct voice, and she could win that based on this like Tennessee law. So like different states have these different laws that are going into place to try to like protect either private citizens or the state government or the federal government or private industry to try to assert this kind of digital sovereignty in different places.
And so going off of this, with the US trying to assert, you know, globally some form of digital sovereignty policy, what kind of geopolitical tensions are we seeing with that, both with countries trying to adopt these measures and from countries having already adopted these measures?
I mean, I think some geopolitical tensions actually are what have prompted this conversation, right? So like in 2013, when Edward Snowden famously like came out and had this bombshell report where he was like, basically the American government is using American private sector data to conduct American surveillance. The whole world sort of, I don't know, I think their jaws dropped seeing that. And that story is really complicated, but it did impact the way that the world thought about how it seemed like American tech companies were sort of owning a lot of the data, which gave them a lot of geopolitical power. And that sort of kicked off this conversation in a big way. And then a couple of years later, Angela Merkel, who was like Chancellor of Germany at the time, who's someone I like think is really interesting, she said in 2015 that Europe had, well, I think her exact quote was like, now is the time Europe needs to secure its digital sovereignty. And that kicked off this whole like conversation in some way. So geopolitics actually like sort of, I think, impacts this and prompts these conversations. And then there also are some things that are coming as a result of some of these laws, which I think is like sort of what you're asking for. So like a good example is that State Department cable, that's like a direct confrontation between the US and in many ways European allies, who are the ones that are primarily passing these data sovereignty laws. But it's also like so many countries are geopolitically thinking about this. Russia has been in like an isolation spiral since the war in Ukraine, where they've slowly been blocking more and more places. I mean, like 10 years ago, I was in Russia like 10 years ago, and you could access almost everything on the internet there at that time. But in the last 5 years, and actually in Russia, like 10 years ago, Alexei Navalny, who was like the major player in Russia that was like the opposition leader against Putin, he was actually like building his platform in part on YouTube. Like he was building like expose documentaries about the Russian oligarchy and like how the current government was bad for ordinary Russians. And in many ways, he was able to build his movement because of platforms like YouTube. But in the last few years, Alexei Navalny sadly passed away, and right. Also Russia has banned YouTube.
Right.
And not just that, but they've also, more recently, they've begun to ban Telegram, and Apple has gone along with it. Apple has pulled the Telegram app from their app store in Russia, which makes it so that people who are sort of in opposition there are having a harder time sort of communicating to each other. But also there have been reports that like Russian soldiers typically have been relying on Telegram in Ukraine because it's an end-to-end encryption system. And so it's actually sort of hurting their military. Like there are all these like things that are interconnected when a country makes this choice. And they have like, I think Russia now has like its own state-sponsored app that's supposed to be like Telegram called like Max or something. But it happens in those places too, right? So like China, famous. Russia increasingly isolated. Iran famously shut down the whole internet as the protests broke out earlier this year there. And that's been up and down since like the Iran war has started. But in Iran, they were able to do that in part because the Iranian government privatized the whole infrastructure of the internet there. So that gave them the power to be able to like shut it down like that. So it happens in really extreme ways, but it also happens in like less extreme ways. So in low and middle income countries, which is like a lot of countries around the world that aren't like the richest of the rich, they're facing pressure from all of these other places to make different choices that I think are really challenging for them. So like countries across Africa and Central and South America and Southeast Asia are getting pressured by the US to deregulate and have open markets for all the tech companies. And the US is saying, like, we want to invest in your country. Why don't you make sure that it's easy for us to invest? And you can do that by not having crazy regulatory frameworks that our companies have to like jump through. But at the same time, China is saying, well, we'll invest and you can pass whatever laws you want, because all we want to do is just like be able to build the infrastructure and for you to pay us to build that infrastructure. And in fact, we'll even give you open source models of artificial intelligence, which are easier for you to implement as long as you pay us to do it, because they're in competition with the US. And so a lot of these countries are sort of caught in the middle and having to make these decisions about like, where does your private citizen right versus your country's sovereignty right versus like the private company investment that you need to ensure a good life for your citizens come from. And it really does make things, I think, challenging for like a lot of people around the world where they just don't have the power to be able to do much. They're just trying to like make the right choice. I think in many ways, like it's a bunch of bad choices. How do you make the least bad choices?
Right. Know? Yeah. Continuing that point a little bit, we're talking in very large kind of national and legislative terms and context. But I think the biggest question our audience is going to have is kind of, how is this going to affect them? And so we've seen some talking points, especially coming out of the EU with all the legislation they're passing, that it'll create, you know, reduced dependency for Europe and greater resilience, better compliance with their laws. It'll give them a competitive advantage inside of Europe for European companies. It has cultural and societal considerations and security and strategic benefits. But is that all the case? And My real question is, I want to get into the concept of the splinternet. Are we seeing kind of the death of the internet that we've all kind of, you know, lived with for 20, 30 years now? Or is this just an evolution?
I know, right? I don't know. I don't think anybody like really knows, but I think that's the question that we should all be asking. I mean, I think like in terms of how is this impacting like a normal person's life that's living in Florida, like a lot of what you'll see and the way that it'll impact you is like if you travel. So if you travel somewhere, you're going to see that if you go to Canada, for example, and you get on Facebook in Canada, you can't share a news link there because Canada has laws that Meta said are too onerous, and so we don't want to allow you to share links. So if you go there, you'll see that. If you go to like the UK, you might get different, like weaker iPhone security because of where you live. There are like different things like that. And of course, for normal people, a major impact is like the cookie consent stuff where you have to like click accept all. I think that's the easiest way to sort of understand how this might impact you. But there's a lot more that's coming. And the things I'm trying to like tell my friends to think about is like, when you look at an AI summary, does it feel accurate to you? Does it feel like you're getting some sort of like sway in one direction or another? That could be because of some of the laws that have been passed where you live or the way that a private company has decided to like present information to you. I think like there is, to your question about like, is the splinternet here? Is internet fragmentation already super far gone? I personally don't think that we're quite there yet, except for in some extreme examples like in Cuba and China. But I do think that we're on our way to a world where that could be increasingly possible. And I think that's going to be like rough for humanity. And it's going to cause us to have a lot less trust in, you know, information that we see almost everywhere, which I think will be kind of rough. One thing that I think everybody should sort of be paying attention to right now that's really related to this are like the digital ID laws that are coming through here in the US. There's a big conversation about digital ID laws and around the world too, which are really a good example of digital sovereignty because it really is all about like who owns your private data. Like, do you own your own private data, or does the government own how you act on the internet, or does like a private company own that? And if you're the one, like, I think most people would be like, well, I should own my own data, right? But if you want to own it, how far are you willing to go to make sure that you own it? Are you willing to actually show exactly who you are, to everywhere that you go on the internet by connecting your personal ID to everything you do on the internet in order to actually like implement and show that all the stuff you're doing is all yours and is not being accessed by other places, because that would require you to give up some privacy in a certain sort of way and potentially to give up a feeling of free speech on the internet. Or do you want like a world where like sort of nobody can own it somehow? Do you want to try to legislate the cookies out of existence? I think the Girl Scouts would have a hard time with that because they're selling a lot of cookies. Right. But like, I think that there's like a big question of like, how do you legislate these things? And those conversations are happening now. Digital ID laws are like in the conversation here in the US and will really impact the way a lot of us operate on the internet. And so that's the main thing I'm trying to get people to think about right now, because I think that's really going to impact things. But right now, like in the current moment today, your passport is, I think, going to determine what you see online. And it's going to be more and more important that you think about how to access global news networks, potentially think about how to use a VPN in the future to make sure you can kind of see what global perspectives are on the news and on the world so that you don't get stuck in a crazy echo chamber.
Absolutely. And just to add a slight point to that, here in Florida, we have also seen that kind of digital ID law already start to take effect, especially with adult websites here in Florida. Mm-hmm. You need to put in your government ID of some form in order to access the site. And I imagine that's only going to grow in certain areas.
Yeah, totally. And like the same thing is true. Like in Texas, they have a law like that too. And I think like that's a good example of like sort of the concept and the push pull that I think has like real merit to have like a deep discussion about, right? Because I think originally the dream of the internet was sort of that like there would be this democratized information space where like everybody in the world could access the same information, which would be great for humanity overall, right? Which is a great dream. And I think the internet in large part has actually held to that dream, which has been really cool in my lifetime to kind of see, even as it's been skewed by weird algorithms and stuff. But even in that like freest, purest form of the internet, we've had guardrails around some things that we think are too harmful for society, right? So like the digital ID laws, I think, come from this idea that like on the internet, we probably don't want to have child pornography accessible to everybody. And if someone's putting that onto the internet or consuming it on the internet, we want to know that. And we want to make sure that those people can't keep doing that and creating victims. So I think like the conversation about like, how do we implement a safe place on the internet versus how do we protect our free speech and our private lives on the internet? Those are kind of sometimes in conflict. And that's like the conversation that I think we all need to think about, because there are going to be trade-offs to however we legislate those things. And they're all important. And it's important not to get it wrong, because we'll lose something important if we don't strike the right balance there, right?
And so overall, it seems like this is kind of a very important topic that's still very much in flux and developing quickly. So something to for sure keep everyone's eyes on as it continues to grow, because this is going to be something, from what you're saying, that, you know, we're going to have to make decisions about as not only a country, but as voters, as internet users and everything like that.
Yeah, I think it's something that sometimes feels far away from our individual lives. But as more and more of us live online and spend a lot of our time on screens, whether we like it or not, those decisions are being made, and we have to decide if we want to be a part of that conversation and that decision-making process. And if we do, we need to really, really learn a lot more about it and be vocal about like what it is that we want our country, our state, and the world to do to build the internet and the digital world that will benefit all of us the best.
Absolutely. Well, Drew, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me on this topic. I learned a lot, and I feel like it's very important. As it's developing, I feel like we may be talking again soon, but I really appreciate you taking the time to speak with me today.
Yeah, of course, it's been a pleasure.
Unbothered is produced, edited, and hosted by Jason Acuna. Audio engineering by Taylor Cox. Executive producers Regan McCarthy and Lynn Hatter. And brought to you by WFSU Public Media.